Thanks. Before I get started, two things. The first one is that since we have three conveners up here, presiders, I think what we should do is at 5 minutes, you should stand up, Matt, and then at 3 minutes, you should stand up too, Aaron, and then at 1 minute, you should stand up, and then when my time's out, you just come and tackle me. All right, in seriousness, the real thing that I wanted to say is that, one, I want to really compliment the organizers for having this session. I think it's just really fantastic to do this, and it's refreshing to see soil science taking on some of these issues. So thank you guys for doing that. And then two, thanks for the invitation to talk in this. So with that, before I take up all my time and have Matt stand up before I even start, I'm going to get into my talk. And I tend to move around a lot. So if I'm talking loud and I get too close to the microphone, or I'm talking too quietly and I step away, let me know. You guys can let me know. Okay, Ron brought up, I think, a really great beginning here to talk about societal challenges and how soil science fits into that realm. And food production is a really obvious one. And I want to go with another one that I think is somewhat obvious, but it's the water side of the equation. And I gave a talk yesterday, and this is kind of part two, but it's independent, so you don't have to have been there yesterday, because I can tell from the audience that most people were not. And so what I want to do is talk about water and water stresses. And I want to give a little preamble here that when I think of water stress, for the last 20 years close, I've been working on water issues, soil water issues, and most of that's been in the developing world. And recently my attention has switched back to more domestic issues. I want to explain why. And I think this epitomizes challenges that we're going to see across the globe. A lot of it's in my backyard, or Ron's backyard as well, so in the western U.S. and Thomas's backyard. But I want to use specifically California as an example here at first and talk about what we're up against and try to bring where soils comes in on this. So if you know anything about California and California's water system, it's really predicated on how precipitation comes. And what I mean by that is that the conveyance system for water is set up, first of all, that we have snow from about December through February, March. And that gives us a storage mechanism. So we're storing it up in the Sierra, and this is what it would look like, right? Okay. So then what we have is that during about in March or so, oh, yeah, so one more slide. So this is where all the snow comes, right? So all the blue there, that's the Sierra Nevada mountain range. The rest of California is going to need some of that. So that's what's stored from December through March. And then what happens, so I'm going to move around. So then what happens is it starts to melt, right? It comes down and you fill up the reservoirs, right? So you have storage. So now you can store that water and you then migrate it around the state. I'm from Northern California. I grew up in Northern California, so I think of Southern California as being really bad because they steal a lot of our water. But a lot of it goes to food production, so that's a good side, right? So we go out and we have food production. Okay, that's California's water management system is predicated on that snow melt, filling the reservoirs, conveying that water around. So all of us know that one of the other things that we have to think about, and Ron ended his talk talking about carbon storage in soils and thinking about climate change. And so climate change, another word that we can use scientifically objective, is global warming. Right? So if we look at the climate models for California, some of them, that the signs are different for whether we're going to be wetter or drier. So let's forget that. Let's just say that we're going to be exactly the same amount of precipitation is going to come. But we know that we're going to be warmer. And what that does is as we warm, the snow level starts creeping up. And what that does is it transfers our snowpack to rainfall. So instead of storing that water in the Sierra, it's going to come running down. And this is basically our challenge. And for California, it means that if we're warming, we switch snow to rain. Okay? So snow to rain means that now we have to store that water. Instead of a snowpack, we have to store it somewhere else. And what's the obvious way to store it? What do? You build more dams. Right? Have to get an interactive audience going here. Build more dams, right? Build more dams. Okay, that's the obvious thing, but turns out that this is true for California, but it's also a global issue. These are the number of dams that have been built over the last century, a little more, but close enough. And that's tapering off because we realize what it's, oops, I almost did this yesterday too. What it does, I think I better find out, what it does to our waterways in terms of endangered species. No, that's not why. It's curving off because we picked all the low-hanging fruit, right? You look at the geologic features that we need to put in a dam, use California as an example, and you say, forget about endangered species. Let's just put in every dam we can possibly do. And guess how much you increase the water supply in California? About 3 to 4%. That's it. So you're trying to offset all of Sierra snowpack with 3 to 4% increase in surface storage? Yeah, the math doesn't pencil out so well there. Okay, so what do? What's the alternative then? You got to think more creatively. So the alternative is, if you can't store it above ground, the other way is put it down into aquifers or potential aquifers, right? So unsaturated subsurface, and that's where soil science comes in, right? Soil chemistry, specifically soil biogeochemistry, I think better yet said, is that once we put that water down in the ground, we have some new challenges that start to come in. One, we have to get the water in there, but two, once we do, we're going to set up some new dynamics that are going to happen in terms of the chemistry and the biology that can change how we think about water. And this is really the big crutch, and this is something I pointed out yesterday, but I want to do it again because I think it's really people that are working in water management, so to Ron's point, trying to talk with people that are policymakers, they're not cognizant sometimes of the difference between surface water and groundwater. And one of the really big things is a simple thing that we think about in if you're doing a batch experiment in a lab, you think about this a lot, and that is the surface area to volume ratio. So how much surface area is compared to the water volume? So if you go to a surface reservoir, use a metaphor here, we could have a lead-lined lake. The volume to surface area is so great that unless we have something that's incredibly soluble, we're basically going to dilute it out, and we don't worry about it. Okay, so surface reservoirs, we worry about all the stuff Thomas just talked about getting into them, but we don't worry about the indigenous contaminants that might be there. We don't really worry about metals per se as much. When we go to the groundwater, then that inverts, right? Now you go from, say, 1,000 to 1 volume to surface area to 1 to 1,000. And so a little speck here and there in the sediments of, let's use arsenic, right? So anybody who knows, that's always the one I always pick on. So arsenic, right? A couple specks of arsenic here, they dislodge from that sediment. So if we dissolve them, just a little fraction of that, all of a sudden our groundwater over vast areas can be compromised. And that is then what we have to start thinking about as we go to groundwater. And so that's what I want to set up next, is talk about some of these groundwater quality challenges. And I want to start with one that's probably been the most notorious over the last year or two, right? And so I left off what the contaminant is because I figured everybody can help me on this. So Flint, Michigan is, what's the problem?
Lead,
thank you. So it's lead, okay. All right, so here's Flint, Michigan's water. This is Detroit's water, right? It was when they switched from the Detroit water to the Flint, Michigan, to the Flint River that they started getting this problem. This one has lead in it, and that's, lead is always really orange, right? Now it's not. That's the iron oxide, that's rust in there, but it shows you the difference. All right, so the Detroit water doesn't have lead in it, but the Flint water coming out of the tap does. Where's the lead coming from? Yeah, it's not coming from the Flint River, it's coming from the pipes. It's the distribution system. So when you think about lead, this is the problem for lead in drinking water. Now, how many aquifers in the U.S. have lead in them? Anybody want to take a guess? Yeah, basically none. So why is that? And that's because, well, let's hold on there. Let me do one more. So lead is one of the most ubiquitous elements that we've used, right, over a long time. So you go back to the Roman times, and you can find layers within soils and date those and find out that was lead that was used. This is actually from a site in France. So you can find historic Roman activity when they were using lead, and you can find that deposition period. You can find the signature isotopically that was from Roman times. We can see the additive of gasoline. And what's really interesting about this is that if you look down through the soil profile, is that the lead concentrations basically hold going down, meaning you're not getting a lot of migration, right? And that is where the wonders of soils come in, right? That they are just tremendous adsorbents. So we have these minerals, organic matter in here, that are fantastic at binding things. So it scavenges lead out, and this I picked a slide by Gordon Brown, and then I made my slide kind of like Gordon's. For everybody who knows Gordon, my Gordon-esque slide, right? Lots of stuff on there. But point being is that lead, even if you go to Missouri and you find these mill tailings, massive mill tailings, this is actually a chat pile, as they call it, it's bigger materials, and you look at the groundwater, this is actually where that stuff came from, so this is all mined out. But the water down there has almost no lead in it. And there's places where this is refilled and they're using it as drinking water. It's hilarious. But anyways, it's okay because it actually has low lead. All right, and this is the really great thing then, right? So we're getting that strong partitioning onto soil solids. Lead is a great example because whether we're an aerobic system or we go anaerobic, lead partitions the solids, and that's why we don't ever see a lead problem. There's no trigger for lead to come off unless you go really acidic, right? And that's not typically what we're seeing. And then I love this. This is soils are often known as nature's kidneys. I love that term. Right? And I think we should populate that, right? Soils are super important for this. Okay, so they do a wondrous job until they don't, right? So sometimes the great ability of soils to retain things can flip on us. And I want to give a really short example that almost probably everybody knows, and if you know me, it's like, oh, he's got to talk about arsenic in Asia. Yeah, well, okay. So I just a few slides though on this. So if you're really looking at the largest geographic distribution of contaminated water, it's in Asia. It's all naturally occurring arsenic. It's coming down out of the Himalayas. It deposits down. Matty P is over here. So Matt did his PhD thesis is all on this work here. And it's impacting a massive number of people. So there's a huge volume of groundwater that's contaminated by arsenic. It's all naturally occurring. And what happens is that in these areas where you have these alluvial deposited sediments, you have dissolved organic carbon. Under anaerobic conditions, you have bacteria, then they're taking that carbon and running into CO2. The arsenic that's bound up on iron oxides then gets reductively dissolved. So the arsenic goes to arsenic 3. The iron goes from iron 3 plus to 2 plus. Arsenic goes in the pore water. This water then continues to percolate down and replenish the aquifer below, and now you have an arsenic-contaminated aquifer. Right. That's been happening for millennia. It's nothing that we did. Right? It's just sitting there waiting, and the problem came about when we came in to tap groundwater to get around surface pathogens in this case, so it was a good cause. But the arsenic was there all along, and we just started pumping it out and using it, and that's where we started to see the health ramifications. Okay, there's not a lot we can do about that. There's nothing that we did that caused this, right? So we just have to figure out if we're going to use groundwater in this situation, what the solution is to pull the arsenic out, and that's a separate issue. It's really not that difficult. But I want to flip for a moment and talk about what if we have some of these conditions where we might have a naturally occurring contaminant. In the very end, I'll give you a few more of those. So arsenic is obviously one, because just showed you that for Asia. There's others. So in California, a big one for us is chromium, and I want to use that as a now backdrop to talk about another natural hazard that we have. And so these are actually monitoring and supply wells in California that are regularly analyzed for concentrations of dissolved constituents. And this is an chromium, hexavalent chromium heat map. And when you look at that, there's a few things that can jump out at you or should jump out at you. And this is one of them, right? So huge concentrations down here in the LA Basin. That's us, right? That's us putting chromium into the groundwater. Now, if you go to the Central Valley, if you looked at that map, and you know California at all, there are huge areas of Central Valley that also have hexavalent chromium, and in cases, quite high chromium. The interesting thing about a lot of these, not all, but many of them, correlate with groundwater pumping. So these wells here often have a high correlation between hexavalent chromium and groundwater pumping. Okay, so why in the world would that be? Is there something that we could do? And I'll give you an example, first of all, from Davis. Anybody from Davis here? We got Berkeley covered. Okay, well, doesn't matter. So look at Davis. Davis actually has the city of Davis knows this. It's not reporting anything that isn't unknown. They have a huge problem with chromium. And it turns out that in their supply wells, they see it, but they particularly see it in their irrigation wells. And so the question that comes up is, what would irrigation water be doing to this? And so it could be like nitrate, that you're just pulling it down from the surface. But it turns out that the surface waters don't really have any chromium, hexavalent chromium in it. So there's something in the subsurface that's causing this. And this is the quick of it, is that this is a deposit here of serpentine minerals. And this is in the coastal range. These sediments have eroded down and deposited on the western side of the valley. And what you have in those are minerals like chromite that can react with manganese oxides to form hexavalent chromium. I did my PhD work kind of on that, or no, my master's work actually, even further. So I did it at Davis back in a long time ago, where I used dissolved chromium and reacted with manganese oxides to form chromium 6. The challenge in this one is it's two solids, and both solids have fairly low solubilities. And here is then the problem. If you have a chromium 3 bearing mineral, fairly low solubility, and you have a manganese oxide, fairly low solubility, those two somehow have to interact, right? So what happens is nature has a big blender that comes down and mixes it all up. No, that's not true, right? That's what I do in the lab. But in the field, these two are fixed, right? So how do you do that? Well, let me show you something that illustrates the problem. That separation distance turns out to control chromium 6 concentration really importantly. So when those minerals are close together, the chromium mineral actually is a little more soluble. It dissolves, migrates to the manganese oxide, gets oxidized, and then that reaction just keeps generating. And if they're pretty close together, you can move that along quite rapidly and generate a lot of chromium 6. So very high concentrations. Depends how much you're diluting with groundwater flow. That's separation. When you start moving those particles further apart, then you get into a problem. Well, actually, you don't get into a problem. You have a solution. You don't get chromium 6 generated. That's a good thing. Okay, so that spatial distance turns out to be really important. Well, it turns out during irrigation pumping, what's happening is that, and I should get into this, is that it's the irrigation wells that really are where we see the problem. And what the irrigation wells do is that they are going on and off during the summertime about every 2 to 3, 4 days, depending on the crop and what the climate's like. And so what ends up happening then is that when the wells are off, the water rebounds, and you see even a couple meters to many meters, the water level increasing. Then these wells turn on, big bore wells, and the water draws back down multiple meters. In that flux, this oscillating redox regime, just like you study Aaron all the time, right? So oscillating redox regime, it turns out that when the water level's up in many of these sediments, you get anaerobic conditions. And for manganese reduction, you don't have to go very far into the redox ladder, right? So you get rid of you pull the oxygen down a little bit, you get nitrate out of the system, and manganese starts going really fast. Okay, so manganese gets reduced. When the water level then drops, it reverts, and the manganese gets reoxidized, biogenically mostly, right? So it gets reoxidized, and we form the manganese oxide. Okay, that in itself really shouldn't matter that much, but it turns out that there's a really interesting twist on this, and that is when you cycle these redox conditions, the manganese reprecipitates, and it's the yellow right here, proximal to the chromium minerals. Actually, don't know why, but we observe it repeatedly. I still don't know what the preference is, but there's something about that chromium surface, chromium hydroxide, and we can switch different chromium minerals. The manganese, during that cycle, tends to repartition increasingly against the chromium minerals, and that decreases our separation distance, and we get hexavalent chromium start showing up. The more you cycle that well, the more you do it. And so we can really, we're not causing the problem initially. We have chromium 3 down there naturally occurring. We have manganese down there naturally occurring. They react a little bit. You go out in the Mojave Desert and find low concentrations where they're reacting without any interference. But we can amplify that by causing these redox oscillations that get this proximal distribution of chromium and manganese. Okay, and then this is just then the cartoon version of that where we have chromium 6 being generated within the fringe where we're getting that variable water table. Hey, I'm doing pretty well. Nobody stood up yet. Okay, so I have two slides left that I want to mention. And so what I really want to get to is that we have to be thinking about when we're putting water below ground, we have to think about what that ground is made of, right? What's in it? Do we have chromium? Do we have arsenic? Uranium, actually, for the Central Valley of California is another big one, and that's on a global basis. Manganese is another element we have to think about. So these naturally occurring elements, what are the triggers that cause them to move from being in the solids to being in the water phase? Sometimes, in the case of lead, we partition it under almost all conditions really well on the solid, and we don't have an issue. Other cases, like all these other elements, they're situational. Sometimes they're partitioned really well under the solids, we have no issue, and other times we trigger them because of switches in redox conditions, changes in pH, ionic strength, and so on, and cause these things to go into the aquifer. If we're managing the aquifers, then we have to start thinking about how that's going to take place. One last point that I want to make is there's one other issue that that comes up, and it turns out it's a really interesting physical biochemical linkage that happens. And that's what happens when we go, instead of an unconfined aquifer up near the surface, when we start going deeper into alluvial aquifers where we have confined aquifer systems, a really interesting phenomena happens when we overdraft the aquifer. So if we start pumping a lot of water out, what ends up happening is we go through what the geophysicists call inelastic compression. So at first, when we get maybe, say, 15% overdraft, the aquifer can rebound. After that, what happens is the particles, basically, we decrease the pressure enough, the particles resettle, and you compress the aquifer. Now, if it was all sand and gravels, that really wouldn't matter. But it turns out that if you study alluvial systems, if you're a soil scientist, you know that they're not homogeneous. Within those sands and gravels, you will find clay lenses. And what happens in those clay lenses is that you tend to have a very different chemistry within those than in the sand and gravels. So when you're pumping the water out at first out of a well, you are getting the chemistry of the sand and gravels. As you continue to pump that water and you move across that inelastic compression point, you decrease the pressure, or you can think of it as compressing the aquifer, and those clay lenses become like sponges. And when you squeeze a sponge, what happens to the water in it? It comes out, right? So now all of a sudden the water you're pulling out of your well starts to show what was in that sponge. Now let me ask you, for everybody in here, if you have a clay lens sat that's sitting underwater and it had a little bit of organic matter and everything else, what's the biochemistry, what's the biogeochemistry inside that clay lens? It's reducing, right? And so what's the one, what is, I put it up there just a minute ago, what comes out of a reducing water? What element do we worry about? Arsenic, exactly. And so if you look in, this turns out to be down, this is my last slide, so I'll go fast now. If you look in, it, this is from Vietnam originally, so if you look at the Mekong Delta down near Ho Chi Minh City, where they have big bore municipal wells that were put down 500-600 meters to make sure they didn't have any surface contamination. As they continue to pump the water out and you get this inelastic compression, they start showing arsenic. It turns out, though, that's not just in Vietnam. If you look in the Central Valley of California now, in the Tulare Basin, you're seeing exactly the same thing. You can look at land subsidence and correlate it with arsenic showing up, and it's all because of the same mechanism. That is strictly due to overdrafting the aquifer. And so if we're going to manage our aquifer systems, we should also be thinking about, if we're going to be pulling the water out, we better be thinking about getting that water back in to one, maintain the elasticity, or in other words, the volume of that aquifer, but also to make sure that we don't change the chemistry. And with that, I'm done. So, and I'll thank all the people that did a bunch of the work. So, anyways.
Pop.
Scott's a nice
job.
Or not. Angie. So if healthy people getting less snowpack, so great back here, great complaint, maybe there won't be enough surface water for surface rice irrigation. Does that mean that if they start to come from groundwater, I just talked about that can be a future problem for rice outcourses?
Yeah,
so the Central Valley, as you know, is not homogeneous. And so most of the rice production is up in the northern region. And most of that is first water rights coming off of like Cache Creek and so on that probably will still have enough water to keep running. So I don't know that we'll see it necessarily in the rice producing areas. But as you drift down, maybe in Yolo County, some of the ones that are a little further south, that may start manifesting itself. Chromium is probably going to be the bigger issue, but it won't. Chromium is a great thing to have a problem with rice because it's going to get reduced in the root zone and go back away. The arsenic problem is mostly in the southern parts of the valley right now. Whether it would show up further north, maybe on the eastern side to some degree. And so there you could, but I think it's going to be fairly localized.
Right?
Yeah.
How about the potential residual problem? Is that related to the background of the
No, it's definitely not an abiotic process. It's biotic. So you do see leptothrix and mostly leptothrix that we've seen so far, but you also have the spore formers that are a big issue for manganese oxidation, and exactly which part of the biology we don't know yet, or multiple probably.
From your first few slides, you said we can really build dams since only 2 to 3% water supply, and from your other 30 slides, we can really pump or over pump oxygen. So what do you suggest we do?
Now. Use less water. Now, so I would say that the key to that is managed aquifer recharge. Right? But managing it, being very mindful of triggers that can cause the contaminants to come off into the water. But that's where I think we as soil scientists have this huge role to play, is understanding what that chemistry is and working with water managers to do that. Just as it, not to be self-promoting, but the exact thing happened in Orange County where they were putting their water back into aquifer. They are very careful about managing the inelastic compression, so they don't do that. But they were picking up arsenic, and it turned out that the arsenic was coming off because of a lack of calcium. We can get into that later. And we worked with them to figure out what the problem was, and the solution was simple. It was just to add calcium back to their supply water as it infiltrated down in the ground. Problem goes away. And so there's usually solutions if you know what the problem is, and the catch on this is working far enough ahead so that you catch the problem before it becomes too big of an issue and then resolve it. That's what we can really do, is to work with the water managers to come up with those solutions so you can use the groundwater effectively.